We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about intellectual property and copyright. Now, it's become very easy nowadays, and I think people understand it, very easy for people to access and to distribute a wide variety of information in digital form. And some people would say, well, that's great for information consumers. However, for creative people, this may pose something of a problem. I mean, we have now a question. It's always been a question, but maybe it's a more important question now than it's ever been. And that is, how do we protect the right of creative people to make a living from their work? This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Kenneth Cruz. He's director of the Copyright Office at Columbia University, and his main research interest has been, for some time now, the relationship of copyright law to the needs of higher education. He's been at Columbia since January of 2008. In fact, he was the founding director of their Copyright Advisory Office. And then before that, he served as director of the first such copyright office of its type, and that was at Indiana University at IUPUI campus. He's authored a couple of books on this subject. His book include Copyright, Fair Use, and the Challenge for Universities, Promoting the Progress of Higher Education, and also a more recent book titled Copyright Law for Librarians and Educators. He's comes to this work from a variety of backgrounds. He studied history at Northwestern, got a law degree at Washington University in St. Louis. He practiced law, general business and corporate law, in the Los Angeles area for a number of years, primarily for people in the entertainment industry. And then he went back to school, got his PhD at the School of Library and Information Science at UCLA. And he's here visiting the campus to talk in the MillerCom series. His hosts here are the Graduate College and the University Library. He'll be giving a talk, Who Owns Your Scholarship? Copyright, Publication Agreements, and Good Practice. That's this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Alice Kemble Alumni Center. Now, these programs, these MillerCom programs, are always free and open to the public, so anybody who's interested in stopping by should feel welcome. And also, if there are people who are listening this morning, I expect around the university community, we will have people listening. Maybe you do have a question specifically that has to do with this issue, this broad category of copyright and higher education. Certainly, people could call and ask a question, and I know that our guest would do his best to give you an answer. I thought it would also be good maybe to talk in a little bit more general terms about this now increasingly complicated area of intellectual property and copyright and why that really matters, why it is to people who would say, well, I'm not a writer, I'm not an artist, but I do read and I watch television and I download music and I do all those things. Well, why should this really matter to me as a consumer of all of this kind of material? So questions certainly are welcome. All we ask of people is that they try to be brief and try to stay on the topic, but you can call in, talk with our guest, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. We have had before here on this program some conversations of these issues, intellectual property and copyright and so forth. And I hope that people will have some idea of why this field is particularly important for a wide variety of folks, artists, musicians, people who write, people who do research, a lot of folks. And we can, you know, if people aren't sure, we can talk about that. But I think what's maybe been missing from some of this conversation is that for a more general kind of audience in a way, why they should care. What, you know, there has been a lot of debate about issues of copyright and who gets to control their material and in what way and for how long and who should have access to it and all these sorts of things. And for a lot of people, I guess their question would be, well, so what? I mean, why should I care? Why should just your average person care about copyright?
David, what a great question. And it's really a pleasure to be here. And thank you for the invitation. Mm-hmm. Thanks to everybody at the University of Illinois. It's good to be in Illinois again. I've visited here many times, and it's always a pleasure. And so you've asked a litany of really big questions in just the last 2 minutes. Your opening statement was something about how do you protect this material? How does somebody make a living off of their copyrighted materials? And then you got to questions about why does it matter? And the question that I just love, which is the question of so what? The big who cares.
Yeah, the big who cares.
The big who cares. And I think, honestly, that's a really important question to be asking right now. Let me put it in one of those contexts. It's like 200 years of history in 30 seconds. And tell you where copyright kind of came from and where we are right now, which goes to the question of why we need to care even more. For centuries, we've had some form of copyright law. We have in this country for more than 200 years, in other countries for longer. We've had some form of copyright law, but it's always been kind of this isolated cloud that it was difficult to get into this area of copyright. You actually had to write something. You had to prepare it for printing, et cetera, et cetera. And very few people were able to enter the realm of copyright. And so for most people, they didn't care at all. And then even if you weren't the creator entering that area, you were acquiring, you were watching the stage play, you were reading the book. You didn't care about copyright either because there was nothing you could do that would trigger any copyright concerns with respect to that material. It was very difficult to create and enter. It was very difficult to use the material that came out of the system. But that has changed for two reasons. One, you've already referred to, the technological change that's occurred. And on this digital revolution that we're part of right now means that it's tremendously easier to enter the copyright system because, in fact, we are all creators of copyright-protected materials. So we have all entered the system, whether we're aware of it or not. And second, because we're all able to access, see, read, watch, download, whatever, a vast variety of materials off of the internet and more sources than that, it's tremendously easier to use somebody else's system, somebody else's work, and that comes out of this system. And so as a result, the copyright regulation, if I'm on one end of the transaction saying, what's mine and what do I do about it? And if I'm on the other end of the transaction saying, now what can I do with somebody else's material? The copyright rules of that game are now important to all of us. And then the other thing that changed, and we'll want to build out from there, I know, and I'm eager to hear questions, that the other thing that's changed is that the law changed. Now, if the law didn't change, we'd still have what I just described. But in fact, the law changed. And the law changed, particularly, at least with regard to American law, it changed in the 1980s to move us toward automatic copyright protection. So that you didn't have to do anything. You didn't even have to know anything. In fact, if you didn't want the copyright, too bad, you got it anyway. So we were all pushed into this system as creators of works. And then the law changed, too, in terms of the interpretations of exceptions like fair use and the creation of new exceptions for how we as citizens are able to use other people's copyrighted works. And then you can imagine from that attention. Because somebody says, I'm in the system and I want rights. Somebody else is saying, but I'm in this system too as a user, and I want to be able to use your works. And so I would contend, and I'll pause for more reflection, but I would contend that we're all on both sides of this equation simultaneously, and we all have mixed feelings. We all want to be owners at some point, and we all want to be users at others. Will somebody please tell me how to play this game?
Yeah, and I think it's complicated, I think, now by the sort of ethic desire for sort of unlimited free use of everything that we've and that the internet has gotten us into thinking that that should be the case. And, you know, I think about the fact that that word copyright, that goes back to a point where if I had written something, what I'm doing is I am granting you the right to make a copy. And at one day, that would have been you'd sit down with mine and you'd have a pen and paper and you would make a copy. Well, it's a whole lot easier now to make copies. And that's what maybe makes it so critical. It's easy for us to do it without thinking and perhaps without thinking about whose right it is we're trampling on
by
doing that, because it is so easy. And that there is so much material that's that seems just sort of to be out there. And I guess we really don't think about the ownership issues. We don't really think about so much that that was created by somebody and they, it belongs to them, and that they have some, you know, some rights to.
You're exactly right, and I'm going to build on it from there too, because yes, we need to be aware as a citizen finding, using, downloading, printing, whatever, that there are copyright implications, and that maybe indeed somebody does have some legal rights associated with this. It raises the question of what should be those legal rights. And the changes we've talked about are reopening that question. Congress makes the law. So, Congress, what rights should an owner have? Congress gets to decide that. There's nothing inherent about copyright. Congress gets to make it. Or, Congress, what rights of use should an individual have? There was a time when transcribing something manually with pencil and paper was the edge of technological development. And in fact, there were debates many decades ago over what is fair use when I write notes from a book. Well, of course, we're doing much more than that now. So Congress, courts, what is fair use? What should we allow? And then what we've discovered by virtue of this expanding law and our expanding involvement in it is that we're all kind of looking at ourselves and realizing, you know, even though the law is a roughly speaking a one-size-fits-all kind of law, you know, not all copyright owners are created equal. Not all copyrighted works are meant to be equal. And so we may very well have, as we do in fact, have individual creators saying, you know, I want all my rights on that work, but I want to let go of some of my rights on this other work. And so we see the creation of something like Creative Commons, which is a standardized system of putting a permission on your work. It's mine, but I hereby allow, for example, non-commercial uses of this work. Mm-hmm. You're letting go because the law says you have rights, but you don't have to exercise them. So we're discovering the nuance of this situation.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kenneth Cruz. He's director of the Copyright Office at Columbia University, and his main research interest as an academic has been the relation of copyright law to the needs of higher education. And he's here to talk about that very thing. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon in the MillerCom series. I thought here on the program, he said he'd be happy to come talk with us. And I thought it'd be a good idea to maybe talk in a little bit more general terms about what it is this is all about, why it matters, and how it touches everybody. Questions are welcome. We have several. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We will start with someone in the community of Belgium, not far away, line number 4. Hello.
I need to get back to essentially the very beginning about the idea of copyright. If I take and build an object, which I do, I make a box or a cabinet or something, and I take this box and I give it to you and I sell it to you for whatever price we negotiate, you take that box and carry it on and do whatever you want with it for the rest of eternity. Now, why is it that a writer can come up with an idea, put it on paper, sell it to you for whatever price is negotiated, but yet why does he get to retain more value after the sale than I do?
Good question. And I think where it takes me is back to you may not have realized it, but I think you're describing the difference between copyright and patent.
But no, not really, sir. The piece of article I take is a work of art, okay? So it's really not patentable. It's a piece of artwork, like a Rubens or anybody else you might think. They sold it one time. People got to sell it many times thereafter, and we reap all kinds of profit from that, but the original artist gets nothing back again.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm with you. So let's get rid of the box example. That's what was making me think of an invention. It's a device or something. And that would be patent law. And you would get you would get 20 years of protection maximum under patent law, et cetera. But I can tell that's not where you wanted to go. If I write a book, the law today gives me instant automatic copyright protection for that book as an original work. If I'm an artist and I make a painting and it's an original painting fixed on canvas, I'm going to get, under the law today, instant automatic copyright protection in both of those examples. And in both of those examples, I'm going to get a bundle of rights, the right to control making copies and a few other things that are all important. And I'm going to get to keep those rights for an incredibly long period of years. Yeah, I get those rights for the rest of my life plus 70 more years. So my heirs can enjoy whatever benefits may come from them. Let me back up to that middle piece, which was where I said you get a certain set of rights. If somebody makes copies of my book or copies of my painting, in either case, short of fair use and other exceptions, presumably that's one of the rights that I have as the copyright owner. You're supposed to come see me about that. What you're doing might be fair use. That's another discussion, but let's pretend like it's not for the moment. That then you have to come back to me in either case. So in fact, in your example, the painting and the book are treated exactly the same way.
Sir, may I interrupt for just a moment?
Go ahead.
What I'm talking about more is more a utilitarian object than just a painting, though, sir. You have to realize what I'm going there. Even though the bowl I might turn out is like a work of art, it still is an actual object you can use.
Okay. Hang on. I need to just pin down a few things because you're back to describing it as a utilitarian work.
But there's a middle ground there is what I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, you know, in fact, let me pause and maybe just wrap it up this way, because I don't think I'm really going to be able to give you the answer you're looking for. But I will say this, that it is true that many works that have artistic qualities and hence could be protected by copyright also can have utilitarian qualities. What the law tries to do is it tries to either separate those qualities. So if the art images, if you invent the bowl and also put original artwork on the side of it, that what the law tries to do is separate that out and say you get copyright for the art images, but you have to go to the patent system for your utilitarian invention, the bowl without the paintings. But if the two can't be separated, and there's a very important case, and I just saw an example of it outside on the street this morning. You know, those familiar bicycle racks that look like a piece of spaghetti that's woven in a ribbon style and then anchored at both ends in the ground. That is, in the hands of one person who created that, that would be a work of sculpture. And if that's what it is for that person, the copyright system is going to give it protection as an artwork. But in fact, that was created by somebody who said, here's a classy, nifty new bicycle rack. And in the hands of that person, it was a utilitarian object that cannot be separated from what might be seen as its aesthetic qualities. And the legal system pushed that out of copyright and into patent. You need to go there if you can't separate utilitarian qualities from the artistic qualities. That might be the best I can do for you right now.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. On to another caller, and this is someone here. We have a couple of people here in Urbana. First in line, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I have an actual problem to present to you. There was a book published in 1978, posthumously. The author died in 77. It's a classic work on the growing of gesneriads, which is a rather limited field of interest to...
That's a plant? We're just wondering, that's a plant?
It's a family of plants.
Okay.
Including the African violet.
Wow.
And several hundred other ornamental plants.
Okay.
Streptocarpus, columnea. Anyway, Max Deckling wrote this book, an expert. I think most of us who consider ourselves experts agree it is one of the two best books on the subject. Unfortunately, the publisher, GSN Magazine, went out of business between 5 and 10 years later. Deckling's wife would be a very old lady if she's still alive. She had a son who may well still be alive.
This is really a great story, but I think for purposes of our audience, let me see if I can help focus in on a few things. Do you want to wrap up the story? And I'm going to focus in on a few generalities here.
I can do it in about two sentences.
Great.
Many of us would like to see it republished, but there's no possibility. I would like to use extracts from it, and I imagine that I can under fair use, but I am interested in the limitations.
You got it. Here we go. It really is fascinating, and I really do love stories like this. Here's the framework of the law. Published in 1978, and you did mention that the actual author had previously died, but as I said before, the copyrights live on, and it was true years ago, it's true today. So let's just assume that it was properly published by the rightful heirs, complying with – in 1978, the law was a little quirky. So there was a period of quirkiness in copyright notices and that sort of thing, and 78 was in that. And so let's just assume they did everything right, and so that from a copyright perspective. So this book has copyright protection, and this copyright protection is now going to live on for many, many, many decades. So there we are. What can one do with a book that you find like that? You are exactly right in that – You may, whoever you are, anybody here in the country, can exercise fair use of that book, whatever that may be. We'll come back to that. Or the other option that you alluded to is one can go to the rightful copyright owner, whoever that is, family member of the original author, or maybe, which is a real serious problem I'll be talking about this afternoon, you know, in the academic world, we tend to transfer our copyrights. We sign those publication agreements and give away the whole store off to a publisher. And that's become a serious problem as well. But let's say we track down whoever the rightful owner is. We could secure permission from that person to reprint, use, republish this book, et cetera, et cetera. So you're exactly right in identifying our two paths, and get permission or is it fair use? Those are typically where we are right now. And so the fair use, though, it's a long conversation, but – the first thing we need to know about fair use is that fair use is an exception that lets us, whoever we are, use somebody else's copyrighted work. But all that the law really gives us is four variables to consider. What's the purpose of my use? Nonprofit education is typically favored. Commercial is not. What's the nature of the work that I'm using? In this case, a nonfiction kind of work, published work, is typically more favored than an unpublished or a more creative fictional work. What's the amount that I'm using? A lot, a little, the core of the work, the more important parts, et cetera. And what's the effect on the market? And in this case, it sounds like, you know, there's no current publication, maybe remarkably little market. And so there's an equation in there somewhere where you could use excerpts of it pretty, I think we'd all probably agree, under some circumstances as fair use. But fair use is an open debate. We could set up any set of facts, line up 10 people and get 10 different answers. But so we need to learn a lot and apply those factors in a reasoned, balanced, good faith manner. And so I think those are the most important general points that I can say to you, and I think others listening can probably relate to those in their own situations.
One of the problems is we've been trying to find the publishers of GSN magazine. It was a small botanical magazine.
That's a really good point.
And there, no one in the past 20 years has been able to find any of them.
Yeah, you know, this is so interesting because what the law has done by virtue of having automatic protection for this long period of years, and, you know, blame it on the law. We really should. By virtue of having that kind of protection, the law has created what are called orphan works. And that's what you've encountered, where we can look at it and say we either know or we're certain enough that it is protected by copyright, but we can't find anybody to come forward and claim it. We're willing to even pay them money, but we can't find anybody to track down and answer our letters. And this is a serious, serious problem in the law, and it's a serious problem in all countries where we've all around the world gravitated toward this system of automatic protection for long periods of years. So the orphan work problem is real, and you have found yourself confronting one. Right now, your best recourse is to go back to fair use. And if, in fact, you can't find anybody to accept money from you, if you're willing to pay them, you know, look at that fourth factor of fair use.
Mm-hmm.
What's the effect of my use on the market? And I think we can all look at that and say, what market? Now, no doubt somebody out there is listening saying, hey, tell them about the Google book settlement. Oh, man, do we have another hour to talk? I'm not sure I can even lay the foundation in less than an hour. But watch the news. Watch the news. On November 9th, Google and the parties that they're litigating, negotiating with, they're due to deliver to the court on November 9th a revised, renegotiated settlement, which will involve, if it's approved, massive scanning of books such as the one you just described, making it available, even these orphan works, and how to solve the problem of how Google might collect money off of these works and where does that money go. Watch the news. There's more about that coming right up.
I happen to know I did an interlibrary search a few years ago. I have a copy. I'm sure there are several, probably 100 copies in private hands. There is one copy in the Penn State University Library.
Yeah.
That's it.
Wow. Well, you know what? Today, there's another tool that you may not have used if you were looking years back. Go to worldcat.org.
WorldCat?
WorldCat, like World Catalog.
Mm-hmm.
WorldCat.org. It's a fabulous resource, and it's a blending, merging of database of catalogs from libraries all around the country, all around the world. And plug in your bibliographic information there, author, title, et cetera, and see what comes up. You might be pleasantly surprised. There might be a copy parked in a local library that you just couldn't otherwise have found.
I'll try that. I'm an editor of a very small botanical newsletter, and that's why it's of interest to me.
That's so cool.
Right. Well, thank you for the call. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. We have another caller we'll get right to. I'd like to introduce again our guest for this hour, Kenneth Cruz. He's director of the Copyright Office at Columbia University and has been there doing that since January 2008. Before that, he was director of the first such copyright office of its type and was based at the IUPUI campus of Indiana University. And his main research interest has been the relationship of copyright law to the needs of higher education. Has authored a couple of books. Books, trying to help people with those. He's here to talk on the subject, Who Owns Your Scholarship? That's this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. He's being hosted here by the Graduate College and the University Library, and this is an event in the MillerCom series. So anyone who is interested can stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller. This is line 2, also in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hi. How
yes.
are you, Mr. Cruz? Very interesting. Hold on a minute. Man, their phone's ringing.
put that person on the line.
Too much technology.
Come on.
I'll ignore it. I wanted to say that I hold four U.S. patents. Some of them are closing in on their ending, their lifespan. So I know the difference. There's also, you know, the factor of the design patent, too, which you can own actually, the design of something.
Exactly.
Nike holds design patents on their shoe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I also hold many copyrights because I was in an advertising company for years, and I actually sued a guy once who stole one of my ideas, and God, was that a mess. But I wanted to say my feelings about copyright are people that don't respect copyrights have never held one. They're real property. They're the creation of someone, the author of the book or the design, or the, you know, the article that's been stolen, the record. And it really bothers me that people just are so indifferent about it. And I think the Internet is a wonderful thing, but it's also the biggest, greatest arena of theft ever. People are stealing people's life, you know, life's works, and they're living without any, just with indifferently. I mean, Chinese, whatever. So we either need to get rid of copyright, or I just don't think it's relevant anymore. I don't know what you have to say about that. But
wow.
It bothers me a lot. I hold a lot of copyrights. And I spent a lot of money once suing this guy who stole a concept I had for an advertising campaign. And the legalese BS was just bothered the hell out of me. But I just want to say that. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, bye.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Wow. What a many, many faceted point that you raise. And your lead in certainly didn't lead me to expect your conclusion that maybe one option is just get rid of copyright. Be that as it may. You know what I think you've touched upon is something really incredibly important, and it helps me expand a little bit on one of my opening comments, and that is that we started out with a system that was supposed to, even though by its words it applied to everybody, but as a practical matter, it really only applied to a tiny subset of people and works where you cared enough to get into the system, and the public couldn't do much with them. And you've been in that realm where you've created things that you are eager to protect, and you, in fact, have taken great strides and great bother and expense to protect. But then again, you know, you started out with an opening comment that the people who something like, and my apologies if I don't get it exactly right, people who don't respect copyrights have never owned one. Let me turn that whole statement upside down. And that is that I think one of the reasons why we're seeing a radical shift in many people's attitudes about copyright is because they do own copyrights. It's just the opposite. There's a phenomenon that's going on that's just the opposite of what you see from being inside of one part of the system. That, in fact, anybody who is big enough and old enough to pick up some crayons and scribble on the wall is a copyright owner. Anybody who posts a message on their Facebook page is a copyright owner. Anybody who sends an email is a copyright owner. Anybody who takes a picture on vacation is a copyright owner. That, in fact, what I think is going on is the system has become so absurd in granting instant automatic protection to all of those works, laying this burden of transaction costs and uncertainty onto the system of the way we use and benefit and learn from information, that I think that the legal system of vast overprotection has resulted in a great deal of lack of respect for the protections that somebody might actually care about, like yours. And I'm not saying I don't care about your protections and your copyrights, but I think that the system is actually working and is forcing the public to see it and behave in a very different way. I can find true infringers that I would look at and I just shudder. I can find them. You can find them. But I think that we can also see that there are lots of people out there that are just trying to make good uses of their material. They're buying a legitimate copy of a piece of music and they want to load it onto their iPod. And there are plenty of people out there that will tell you that that's a violation of the law. And that's just not a good, functional, practical working of the law.
Well, that's – and just to do a somewhat related example, we have – on the one hand, we have – because it's so easy to copy and distribute material digitally, we now have a huge problem with piracy, with movies, with music. I'm not so sure it's much as much of a problem with printed material, but certainly movies and music. And then also we have, because so many people have personal digital devices, we have cases where, say I go over to your house and you've got a new CD and you play it for me and I think, hey, that's really great. Could I borrow that? And so you say, sure, and you give it to me and I put it on my iPod. Well, that's a violation of copyright.
Maybe.
Some people would think that at the very least it's immoral if it's not illegal.
Yeah. Be careful. Always be careful about mixing morality and the law. They come from two different sources.
But I mean, I guess my point is that I think that there are some people who would say that there is some kind of functional equivalent between piracy on a large scale and this other example where, one where people are sharing their CDs, and it's not that they're making copies and going out on the street and trying to sell them.
Right.
They just have something. This is really great. You'd like it. Here, just have it. I just give it to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really a fascinating dilemma and a fascinating conversation that will never end. We're going to have this conversation the rest of our lives, plus 70 more years maybe. And it's just going to go on and on. We're not going to solve this. Remember something, too, I said earlier in the program, that it's really back to Congress. Congress makes the statutes and then the courts interpret them. And it's really fundamentally up to Congress to decide the framework of this. What gets protected? What are the protections? How long does it last? And then carve-outs. What are the exceptions, the limitations for the benefit of consumers? And if a court were to declare that loading a legitimate copy of music, even a borrowed CD from a friend or from the library, if a court were to declare that was some kind of violation of the law, now we know for sure, at least in the eyes of that judge, I suspect that there would be enough of a rebellion in the streets and that the voters would send a message to their members of Congress that maybe you need to create an exception here. And to a great extent, that is the way the law works. The law is trying, it doesn't always succeed, to embody some kind of reflection of what creates, what leads to a good practical functioning of society, and what ultimately creates, what ultimately serves the objectives of the law, which might be, on the one hand, we are competing objectives here, to encourage people to create, and then at the same time, to encourage uses that have some social benefit. Can I take a minute and tell another story?
Sure.
Is that all right? You know, in the world of education, one of the best parts of the U.S. copyright law is a code section exception. It's embodied in code section 110, subpart 1. There, we're all gonna know that by heart, aren't we? And I love to point to it because it's one short sentence, and it, unlike just about anything else in the law, it's clear and to the point. And it says something like this: that it permits displays and performances, showing a movie, singing a song, acting out a play, displays and performances in the live face-to-face classroom of a nonprofit educational institution. That's a rough paraphrase, but the real statute's not much different from that. And so what that says, let me give you a simple example. It means I'm teaching my class, we're all in the same room together, no internet, no distance ed, we're in the room together, and I own that. I have a DVD that I got from Target of a movie. I can pop it in the machine and show the movie. That's a performance of that copyrighted work. And the law says, by golly, I can do it. Mm-hmm. I was in a sharp debate with somebody that I didn't expect to be in. He wanted to debate it. He was an independent film producer. And he saw that as devastating to his business. And that did you know, he would raise with me in some open forum, that teachers are out there showing my movies in their classes and I'm getting nothing out of it. And I said, well, you're making a sale of the movie, right? That gives you something. Yes, but I'm not getting anything out of the performance of that movie, the showing it. I said, well, I understand, but please understand that that's the law, that clearly Congress absolutely allowed that teacher to show that in the classroom, and there's a decision. Well, that wasn't good enough for him, of course. And what he was struggling with was the difference between Congress's decision about where to draw that line as opposed to his interests and where he would have liked to have drawn that line. And we all face issues like that all the time. I really want to do this or do that, and I can't control it as the rights holder, or I can't do it because the law says I'm not allowed to. We all struggle with this, but it's ultimately coming down to, where's that line? Where's that line?
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Ken Cruz. He's director of the Copyright Office at Columbia University. Excuse me. He's here to talk about intellectual property issues and scholarship, and we're here talking in more just sort of general terms about what that all means. Questions are welcome. We have a couple. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone next in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I mean, we can blame Congress, and of course Congress is very blamable, but I think we ought to also mention organizations like Disney that I think had an awful lot to do with this this perennial copyright holding.
Well, that's I'm glad you raised the question, because that was something, and it, again, you know, maybe the same we could talk about for a long time. People raise questions about the length of the period and
right.
why it's as long as it is, and does it need to be that long? And it was fairly recently extended, and we can blame Mr. Mouse for that. Same people would say that it was.
In part. There's enough blame to go around. It really is. I mean, I'll show my cards. It was ridiculous. Copyright protection already lasted for life of the author plus 50 years. That's a heck of a long time. And in 1998, U.S. Congress made its decision and increased the term of protection to life plus 70. It's a long, complicated story about early works like the early Disney cartoons and so on from the 1920s. It's a long, complicated story. But the upshot was they were looking at the possibility that pretty soon those would enter the public domain. And of course, Disney was there to say, we have an immediate interest. Congress, give us the 20 more years. And Congress said yes. Now, Congress didn't say yes only because Disney showed up. It's really easy to pin the blame on Disney. Disney was a major player. Disney had an immediate interest, but so did others. The Gershwin estate, with respect to some of their works, were on the brink of expiration. Give us 20 more years. And it's true. It's just an absolute gift from Congress. Here it is. Here it is. Now, among the reasons, though, for doing it, if you want to look for a little bit more genteel reason other than just boldly a bold handout to individual interests. There was a movement in different parts of the world, particularly in Europe, to move toward a standardized term of protection of life plus 70. And one of the major forces on American copyright law and the law of most every country of the world is the international system, the treaties and agreements of multiple countries around the world, and the standards of protection and shape of the law that are in those treaties, that we, in fact, have many provisions of American law. We could say this about the provisions of other countries, too. Many provisions of American law where Congress enacted those provisions not because they were necessarily good ideas. In fact, they might have been bad ideas. But the Congress enacted them because under our international agreements, we had to. If we're going to play the game on the, in these treaties, that we had to play by certain rules. And now we're doing this to other countries. We've taken that Life Plus 70 and have included it in agreements with South American countries, with Australia, and we've included in these free trade agreements that you will increase your term of protection to Life Plus 70, and included other terms too. So all of these countries of the world, I'm not just picking on the U.S., it's a worldwide phenomenon, are exporting and pushing their law on one another, and it's all part of a big international game of trade and creating predictability in the law wherever we go.
Hmm. We'll try to get at least one more caller. Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. The Rome Convention, I understand that basically the U.S. is sort of an outlier, if not an outlaw, on that, and I guess there's some move in the Congress to actually, what this refers to, at least in, as far as how the U.S. has opted out of it, is the royalties for playing on the radio. Right now we have this odd system in the U.S. where webcasting are obliged to keep track of every art played, piece of art played, music, whatever, but radio stations aren't necessarily doing that. It's ASCAP and BMI just basically have their own formula, which basically favors the corporations, in my opinion. I think it's probably a very good idea for artists to get their, you know, and with the information technology we have, it's not impossible. Anyway, if you could unpack that a little and see if I'm right on that. There's no time for you to mention, but mention something about the pervasiveness of corporate influence in academia. I don't know if that's part of what you will be discussing this afternoon, but with the university more and more like a corporation and so much corporate influence, you know, this is maybe not so much for the cultural product, but the technical products that are established at university.
Thank you very much.
I'll hang up.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope you will come this afternoon because I am going to, in the interest of time, just duck the sort of corporate question because it shoots off in a lot of different good and bad directions. We never know where it's going to take us. But the question you raise about sound recordings is really important. How many minutes do I have here?
Oh, about four.
I don't even want to talk 4 minutes on this. I'd love to get one more question in. But I will say this, that the way that the U.S. law protects it gives copyright protection and carves out exceptions for music and especially for sound recordings and especially for the way sound recordings are performed. That's legalese for played, such as played on a traditional analog radio or digital radio or webcasting, the law of all of that is really peculiar. We have a roughly speaking, one-size-fits-all for everything else except those sound recordings and the protection for those. And the upshot is that we have this patchwork of protection where there are performance rights, legal rights in the sound recording. But exactly as the caller mentioned, only in the context of digital transmission as opposed to analog transmission, so that when that piece of music is played on the air on a traditional analog radio station, the recording artist doesn't get anything, but the rights holder of the underlying composition does. But as we move to digital as a new means of transmission, Congress changed the law back in the mid-90s and added a provision that said in the digital context, we're going to give some rights to the sound recording performers or, as you suggest, the production companies that get the rights from them end up getting the stream of revenue. And so it's a complicated mess, but sound recordings are their own creature.
Mm. Maybe we'll try one more caller. Kingmond, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a simple, hopefully simple, question, and it has to do, a very practical matter, it has to do with if I hire a photographer, for example, to take a picture and pay for that and commission him to do that, explain to me how, or at least it's been presented to me by those photographers that they would own that and that they would hold the copyright on that and, not
myself
who would commission him to do it and pay for it, and it's actually my subject. He didn't come out and actually create it and then come and try to sell it to me. Would you comment on that?
I would happily do it. We're down to like 1 minute, so I'm going to give you the condensed version. And this is a fascinating issue, and I've dealt with this question 1,000 times because it's a situation where, from your point of view, photographers would say the opposite, but from your point of view, the law works exactly in an opposite manner from what you see as logical. You're looking at this saying, I paid for it, therefore it's mine, and the law does not do that. What the law does is it says it's yours only if A, you get a transfer of the copyright, which I'm going to tell this afternoon a lot of faculty authors, be wary of transferring your copyrights. In your case, maybe it makes some sense. I don't know. The photographers, again, will tell me that it doesn't make sense. Well, you'll just have to negotiate that. But if you want to end up with that copyright, you better get a piece of paper that says it's a transfer of copyright, that has a signature on it, and go talk to your lawyer and make sure it's done properly. And that's the way you're going to get the copyright. The only other way is if it's work for hire. And there's a technical definition in the statute about what qualifies as a work for hire. And I'm going to tell you, you better go see your lawyer and make sure you get into exactly what's necessary if you want to end up with that copyright. And I'm going to tell the photographers who are listening out there, go see your lawyer and make sure that you get the instrument you need to serve your purposes, and all of you are going to have to negotiate.
All right. There we're going to have to stop. If you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Kenneth Cruz, who is director of the Copyright Office at Columbia University, will be speaking on the topic, Who Owns Your Scholarship? Copyright, Publication Agreements, and Good Practice on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series. It takes place at 4 this afternoon at the Ellis Kemble Alumni Center in the ballroom. That's on South Lincoln. These events are always open to the public and free. So if you're interested, you can stop by. He's here visiting and being hosted by the Graduate College and the University Library. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. Really a pleasure.